Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville, and thanks for being with us on this special encore program as you enjoy your fourth holiday weekend. We're going to spend the hour today listening back to important conversations we had on the show earlier this year.
Climate change and the risk it poses for Florida looks to be the political issue here in the 2020 presidential election, at least 18 months before the election, Melissa.
That's right.
In one poll by Climate Nexus, Yale and George Mason University found 2 out of 3 Floridians surveyed online say they are somewhat or very worried about climate change. Now, back in May, we spoke about this threat and the ability for Floridians to get insurance as the risk from climate change grows.
That's right. And one expert on the impact of climate change on financial markets went so far as to say that no one should even get 30-year mortgages anymore in the state of Florida. This expert says eventually making a home loan for 30 years here in this state will just be too risky. Spencer Glendon of the Woods Hole Research Institute says financial institutions are going to wreck Florida's economy if they don't confront the risk to coastal real estate and quickly change their ways. Spencer Glendon, thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
You made a lot of waves recently when you sounded the alarm about real estate lenders and investors in Florida. You say are ignoring the rising threat that climate change poses here, specifically when it comes to providing mortgages at 30-year lengths of time, which is the typical amount of time, and by buying long-term debt. You're saying this could pose financial calamity for Florida. Can you explain in a little more detail what your research shows around this issue?
Sure. So what I'm trying to help people understand is that what maybe seem like a long time horizon or something that's far away actually isn't far away, because we make lots of decisions in our everyday lives that seem short term. But the foundation of society, of modern life, is a set of assumptions. And the one that I think is easiest to get people to understand is the 30-year mortgage. So it's the foundation of the housing market. It's also 30 years is the time horizon on which the U.S. government often borrows, and it's often used for municipal bonds for things like sewer systems and water purification and electricity supply, things like that, hospitals. And anytime there's a 30-year debt, and the mortgage is the easiest example again, there's a set of provisions within the 30-year debt that 30-year debt will be violated if you breach some condition. And so the condition that I think will be breached in Florida is that of insurability. So you have a lot of places in Florida that are increasingly under risk of flooding, and they're increasingly under risk of having a kind of erosion of the infrastructure that Florida depends on because the ocean is rising and because it's warmer and because the air is warmer. So let me give you a couple of specific examples. When you have a 30-year mortgage for your home, you have a condition that you need to have insurance. That insurance isn't for 30 years, though. It's renewed annually. And at any point in time, the insurers can say, actually, we're no longer offering insurance where you are. That's a very real risk. And as I talk to both insurance companies and reinsurance companies, that is, the companies that insure the retail insurance companies, they say increasingly, we're not going to be in these markets.
They're telling you we're not going to be in these markets, i.e. the Florida market, right?
That's right.
So I guess the question I have and many other Floridians have is, when does that happen? When does that tipping point occur?
Things that are a 1 in 20-year event or a 5% risk are essentially uninsurable in most parts of the world. That's too often for an insurance company to want to intervene and have to deal with claims, and it's too often for them to have faith that the borrower, in this case the insuree, will act accordingly. And so insurance markets dry up once things become more than a 1 or 2% chance. In most of Florida, I think that's most of coastal Florida, that threshold's already been breached. And so I think that any day insurance could dry up in many places for flooding, for nuisance flooding in particular. But more importantly, that should be relevant for new buyers. So the Florida economy is largely built on the promise of continued in-migration. And when new buyers arrive, they need to borrow for an additional 30 years. And what I think will actually dry up is the supply of loans will dry up in anticipation of when the insurance will dry up. So as long as we know that insurance will dry up with any confidence in the next 20 years, Today, no one should lend for 30. And once there aren't 30-year loans available on a regular basis, whether they're from Fannie Mae or a traditional bank, the Florida property market will be in trouble.
You're describing a cascading, spiraling effect that could pull Florida's economy, honestly, into a tailspin. If mortgagers refuse to write a 30-year mortgage, if insurers refuse to insure, if the real estate market collapses, creating, you know, a ripple effect into other industries, other pillars of the economy. This, as you said, this is a state built on tourism and real estate and growth and development. And so your warning is dire enough that it has gotten a lot of attention in the national media. At the same time, what's so remarkable here in Florida, Dr. Glendon, is that most of the players in this space are proceeding as though it's just business as usual. What about that?
It's a remarkable thing. I'm doing this work not because I want bad things to happen in Florida. Indeed, quite the opposite. I would like it to be the case that people start preparing now, because the cascade you describe is exactly right. Florida is especially vulnerable with zero income tax. It depends overly on real estate relative to most places and on construction.
Okay, so if Florida is especially vulnerable due to all these factors and people should start preparing now, what should the average homeowner that's listening to you right now, or someone who's thinking about buying a property in Florida, how should we prepare?
I think that living in Florida probably remains a viable option for a long time. How long exactly is unclear. And so with only a few feet of rise of sea level, you'll have real problems in all of Florida. People should start preparing for that. The one way to prepare is not to take debt on it, pay down their mortgages and or sell. I wish it weren't the case that everyone should sell, but renting in Florida makes perfect sense. Owning in Florida makes much less. The other is that it's a huge political problem. You see, as the ocean gets higher, it gets heavier and it infiltrates the land. Florida is principally made up of porous limestone, and the aquifers on which Floridians depend are starting to become saline. And actually, as one of your former governors told me in person, almost all the toilets flush into the ocean. And as the ocean gets higher, it puts more pressure on those sewage systems. Those municipalities are going to have to prepare for a much more challenging physical environment. And so I think that climate change and adaptation should be a local issue, a congressional issue, a government, a statewide governor issue. And Florida should be asking the U.S. government and others in the country to start preparing both in terms of mitigation, lowering CO2 emissions down to zero, and adaptation.
And some municipalities are going after that more aggressively than others here in Florida. As you just said, you don't think 30-year mortgages should be written in this state anymore. You think people who can sell their homes should sell their homes. What happens, though, if people come to this kind of belated realization and they all start trying to sell their homes at once? Who's going to want to buy them?
Well, part of the reason for me to do this work is that the longer we wait to start this process, the messier it will certainly be. The population of Florida has gone up enormously in the last two decades, with people investing in that place and new infrastructure going in right at the coast. In fact, in many ways, Florida has become more coastal over the last 20 years, which is quite amazing in the face of the fact that the ocean is coming to greet them by rising itself. And so part of the reason for me to do this work publicly is to make people understand the sooner we start the process of unwinding some of these misallocated capital, the less painful it will be. I'm sorry that climate change is going to be painful for many people, and I don't think there will be many winners at all. But if we start acknowledging some of the misplaced capital now and misplaced expectations now, the adjustment will be easier. The longer we wait to start adjusting, the more painful it will be.
Spencer Glendon, PhD, a climate research analyst with the Woods Hole Research Center. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Climate risk, climate cost, and real estate. Is it affecting your neighborhood? Is it affecting where you live now, where you would like to live in the next decade? How is your home insured? How has that insurance changed? Kevin McCarty knows a thing or two about insuring the homes of Floridians. He served as the state's insurance commissioner for 13 years, regulating the industry through the busy storm years of 2004 and 5. You remember those storms, Katrina, Wilma, Charlie, and others. He's the chairman today of the Florida Association for Insurance Reform, and he joins us via FaceTime from Tallahassee. Mr. McCarty, welcome to Florida Public Radio. Thanks for your time today. Is a 30-year home mortgage a fool's bargain in Florida today?
Well, that's difficult to conclude based upon the information we have right now. You know, it wasn't that long ago after 2004 and 5 that the reinsurance market dried up, and many people believe we wouldn't be able to have traditional insurance in Florida. But, you know, the marketplace settled out. We had an influx of capital after the financial crisis, largely due to the influx of capital for insurance-linked securities, which provided another, you know, avenue for mm-hmm. funding. So it's difficult to say with any certainty that, you know, give up on Florida because, you know, there's no capital to support, you know, the continuing growth. You know, it certainly does raise an issue
yeah.
that Florida needs to be cognizant of in terms of rising sea levels.
The previous guest's point was less about insurance, saying that there will probably still exist to be the ability to have insurance. To pay for it is another question, but it's the supply of mortgages. Banks just may not be willing to lend to a buyer who is buying a property in the state of Florida.
Well, I mean, that's interesting to me because there's a huge number of homes in California that are provided mortgages that they don't have earthquake coverage. There are, you know, millions and millions of dollars worth of mortgage property in California that are on fault lines that don't have, simple protection of an earthquake coverage. We know earthquakes are going to happen mm-hmm. in California. It's not if, but when. And when it happens, it will be devastating. Yet the mortgage industry continues to provide mortgages in California. I would say that you can certainly look at that in the same way. I mean, there is, unless something happens dramatically to shift the burden to the banks to actually have to pay for that, they haven't had to in the past.
Yeah. So, Mr. Picard, let me ask you, I mean, the average mortgage in the United States, while it's lent for 30 years, actually only lasts about 5 or 7 years. Commercial right. mortgages, when these real estate developers look to develop oceanfront or waterside property, which is the most expensive and thus has the most reward, also the most risk, those loans tend to be 3 or 5 years in time. Are the incentives just wrong right now in terms of real estate in the state of Florida when it comes to acknowledging in a real way and really addressing the true risk of climate change, because that risk is 30, 40, 50 years down the line?
Well, I think it's fair to say that Florida as a state has not sufficiently addressed the issue of rising water as a result of climate change. I think there have been some efforts made at the local level, particularly in Southeast Florida. Mm-hmm. Miami Beach in particular has made, you know, a Herculean effort to pump water and build an infrastructure in response to that. But you're right. We continue, thousands of people continue to move to Florida weekly and continue to add to the insurable risk in Florida. And that risk is, and a lot of that, is, as our previous guest said, is concentrated within 50 miles of the coast.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that tends to be the more attractive area, which it defies the logic when it comes to the potential for disaster from rising water.
So speaking with Kevin McCarty, the former insurance commissioner here in the state of Florida, talking about climate change and property, your phone calls at 305-995-1800 coming up in just a moment here. But Kevin, I wanted to ask you finally, we're on the eve of another storm season. Insurance rates in the state of Florida, some I know are going to call in and argue with this, but have been relatively stable even with Hurricane Irma and Hurricane Michael and Hurricanes Matthew and Hermine over the last couple of sessions, because there's lots of money that's willing to take the risk still in Florida. What's going to change that risk scenario, though?
Well, I mean, it came about very quickly. It came as a result of the financial crisis because, you know, people decided that things risk weren't as non-correlated. And hurricane risk in Florida created a huge influx of money for that to back that. So right now, there hasn't been any. No storm has really made that difference. But yes, you can certainly see a series of storms or events that happen over a protracted period of time that make the other thing, if interest rates go up, because the interest rates yeah. have been so low, that money has been flowing into this. And that's been another factor.
Yeah, it's the flow of international money into Florida willing to take on that risk, Melissa. Lots of phone calls here. 305-995-1800 is the phone number.
Yeah, no surprise. So many people have questions about their property, their long-term risk, the value of their homes, or their commercial property. Let's go to some of your calls right now here on the Florida Roundup, beginning with Patrick in Tampa. Hey, Patrick, thanks for your call. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for having me. I was just calling to say that I think that the insurance situation has already actually happened to my parents. So they moved here way back in 1991, and they had a mortgage that they've now paid off. But during that time, insurance has, of course, gone up, but it's gone up to the point where they can't afford it anymore. So now they're sitting in their house, the mortgage is paid off, but they don't have
But it's not
any,
insurable.
Are
they in a low-lying area? Are they in a flood-prone area?
It's kind of. It's on Merritt Island, so it's not, like, technically low-lying, but it's on an island, so, yeah.
Okay.
But, yeah, I guess the thing I'm wondering is, like, you know, what are we going to go from here? Because, like, right now they're just kind of sitting in their house hoping that, you know, nothing horrible happens. And
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, Patrick, like, right, I hear you. And, you know, I own a home in Florida myself. But I think so many of us have these questions. And so for Patrick's parents, that's Patrick in Tampa. Thank you for that call. Okay, Kevin McCarty, our insurance expert here. This is the scenario homeowners are worried about and some are already experiencing, that they will simply lose insurability, that they will not be able to secure insurance for their home, which will make it impossible to sell. What answer can we give these folks, and what sort of contingency plans do you think the state should be making to get out in front of this?
Well, I mean, when it comes to the issue of rising sea levels, there's no question that, you know, the state has not made the a comprehensive effort to address that. But if you're looking at the insurability, and go back to your original question about insurability, you know, I think we look back to 2006. And the two biggest issues in the political campaign were the rising costs of insurance and the rising cost of property taxes. And, you know, insurance was one of the top issues on the minds of consumers. And it drove that governor's election and a number of the elections. And I think that's why they expanded the CAT fund to address that at that time. As we have already said, a lot of capital is in the market right now. We haven't seen that kind of rate instability or lack of capital that would create the kind of problem you're talking about. That doesn't mean it can't happen, absolutely. And that's why things need to be done to make our communities more resilient and then therefore more insurable in the voluntary market.
Kevin McCarty is the former insurance commissioner here in the state of Florida. Today, he is the chairman of the Florida Association for Insurance Reform. Kevin, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, that was a program we brought you back in May. And despite the threat climate risk poses for Florida real estate, well, home prices continue increasing. In May, the number of sales and prices for single-family homes across the state were up from a year earlier.
Yeah, it was pretty healthy. The Florida Realtors Group says the median price of a Florida single-family home in May, it was $266,000 statewide, up more than 4% in the past year. The Florida condo median price up 3.7% to $195,000.
Much more still to come, meanwhile, on this Encore Florida Roundup. Over the next decade, three new toll highways could be built in Florida from the Panhandle to the Gulf Coast. We'll look at that in just a moment here on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. We are not taking new phone calls or tweets this week because we're highlighting some of the conversations we've had recently on the program.
That's right, Tom. And one of them involves everybody out there on the roads right now. When Bill Galvano became the leader of the Florida Senate, he made no secret of his top priority, new roads. Back in January, weeks before the start of the legislative session, Galvano called for three roads. He called them corridors.
Look at extending the Suncoast Parkway as a corridor with multi-use to the state of Georgia. to continue the Turnpike connector to the West Coast, and to create a corridor through our rural counties from Polk County south and into Collier County.
Lawmakers and Governor Ron DeSantis agreed, so the state's biggest road project in 50 years is moving forward. Now, the law says the roads are to, quote, revitalize rural communities, encourage job creation, and provide regional connectivity, end quote. We spoke about the road projects in May, whether they were needed or wanted or not, with Senate President Bill Galvano.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So the law refers to corridors. Doesn't it mean roads, though?
No, actually, the law is referred to as MCORs, multi-purpose corridors. It includes roadways, but also includes opportunity for water, sewer, and broadband access. It's a multi-purpose infrastructure proposal that now is underway from a planning standpoint.
So
thanks to the governor signing it.
Yeah, the legislation has been signed into law. A planning standpoint, the legislation creates three task forces to look at these three corridors, which would include roads, the Suncoast Parkway, the Turnpike Connector, and then this new road that would go from around Naples up to I-4 in Polk County, just south of Orlando. In your mind, does this begin to pave the way for the roads as part of these corridors, or could these corridors happen without necessarily new asphalt or concrete being laid?
No, I think it does pave the way, so to speak, for the roadways. The Florida Department of Transportation, now with the funds that have been committed to the trust fund, has the financial capability of moving forward with the planning, development, and engineering. But you mentioned the task force that will look at the feasibility and the design, et cetera. Those are very important aspects, because really what I did was create a committee, the Infrastructure and Security Committee, chaired by former President Tom Lee, and wanted this idea developed organically. And the composition of those task force includes local governments, state agencies, and in particular, environmental interest. And we'll have public hearings. And so all of this is going to be planned together. But it has to happen if we're going to be able to sustain the growth that's occurring in Florida, which is essentially 850 people per day.
Yeah, Senator Galvano, you know the critics point out to say there hasn't been a need study for these roads. You talked about the feasibility studies that the task forces will undergo. There's no specific routes that have been identified just yet. So to call for these three new roadways, to know that these task force are going to lead to asphalt and new pavement, isn't it premature?
No, it's not premature. Right now in the state of Florida, we have what I call a perimeter of prosperity all along the coastlines. But the density has become unmanageable. If you go to Wildwood right now, for example, where the Turnpike intersects with I-95, you're just going to stop. You will literally stop and creep along and for several miles. We saw a great challenge with the evacuation when Irma was hitting the state. So we have this need. When we started down this path, I challenged the Senate to understand that infrastructure and the future of our state economically and otherwise was dependent upon our infrastructure and our investment therein. And I worked with many different groups prior to even unveiling the MCOR idea, and had feedback from people who had looked at these, including former chairs of or secretaries of the Florida Department of Transportation.
As we move forward with this task force, or the three task forces, you mentioned the funds, over $100 million, I believe, transferred into the Transportation Trust Fund. These dollars have to come from somewhere, in some cases going to come from the general revenue. How much of this money is going to be pulled out of general revenue that could be otherwise spent on, for instance, education and healthcare, the two big pieces within the state budget?
Well, just by way of footnote, if we were more aggressive with education funding than we have been in a long time.
Yes,
which
that
is also
true.
But which is a
I'm looking forward here, and you know what the critics will point to is you can only spend the dollar.
Yes,
once.
I'm going to respond to that. But I did want to point out that that was a priority of mine as well, to have balance in education. The funds that are dedicated initially were meant for transportation infrastructure, collected from fees, and they went during the recession into general revenue. We have rededicated those funds through our budget and through this policy because the necessity of having that dedicated and those dollars in the queue coming forward is evident in the fact that we have been playing with our roadways catch up for so many years and trying to remediate problems and adding a lane here or there. The idea is that we will be able to plan. And if all purposes of the multipurpose corridor come into fruition and we are improving water and we septic to sewer and increasing broadband, it will have a reaching effect that will impact even education in other areas. So in order to think forward and not think fix yesterday's problems, but anticipate the future, we need to have these funds in the queue and dedicated.
With that in mind, Senator, do roads address the future, or should you be looking at other alternative transportation mobility issues on these corridors?
Great, great question. And that's right at the heart of at least what my vision has been. You know, we are moving into a new age of autonomous vehicles, electric vehicles. All of these things need to be part of the dialogue when we create these corridors. And that's why at the end of the day, that's what they are, corridors. And I've been a strong advocate for dedicated lanes for autonomous vehicles, things of that nature. And, you know, you may have electric charging stations that in place of where gas stations would be your traditional interior rest stops. So hopefully this is not hopefully that's a directive in putting this together, that we look to the future of travel as well.
But the future of travel still means rubber wheels on pavement.
Yes. And in the foreseeable future, that is correct. As we see technology advance, the Tesla still has tires.
Senator Bill Galvano, the president of the Florida Senate, thanks for joining us today on the Florida Roundup. We appreciate it, sir.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, in April, when lawmakers were considering the bill that starts the process to build these three new roads, the head of the Sierra Club in Florida, Frank Jacalone, issued this warning.
If this bill is passed, we will declare war on all of those who have sponsored it. We will mount the most massive campaign Sierra Club has ever done in Florida in our history to stop those toll roads.
Frank Jacalone joins us now from our station in Tampa, WUSF. Frank, thanks for being with us. So a declaration of war on the legislation that is now enacted to build these three new roads in Florida. You, leading the Sierra Club and other environmental groups across the state, have vowed to fight these projects. You've dubbed them the Billionaire Boulevard, calling it political payback for major landowners and development interests, and even one of the biggest land grabs in decades. Why is Sierra Club going in so hard to fight these new roads in Florida, Frank?
It was Senator Galvano and those people who put this bill together, who declared war on Florida's environment and on the people who live in these rural communities. These bills, this toll road plan, is a disaster in the making. We are opposed to it because it will bring sprawl to the middle of the state and to our Nature Coast area. It will inevitably lead to the destruction of wildlife habitat, and it will turn communities on existing roads into ghost towns. This is not something that we want as environmentalists, that the people in those local areas want. And in addition, it takes valuable money that could be used for not just healthcare, not only education, but for transit in our existing cities. What is the state of Florida doing to make sure that we have modern transit in places like Tampa and St. Petersburg and Jacksonville, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Tallahassee, Gainesville, Orlando? We all need modern transit. The state needs to help out instead of building new toll roads.
And if you're just tuning into the Florida Roundup, we're talking about the prospect of three major new toll roads in Florida. Getting your tweets, too. Here's one for you, Frank, from a listener. Building more roads won't reduce traffic. This is echoing what you just said. We need to invest in alternate forms of public transit to protect the environment and reduce our reliance on cars and gas. Okay, so we heard earlier in the show Senator President Bill Galvano acknowledging that we're moving into a new world of transportation, but centering it around the automobile, he talked about electric cars in particular. Is the Sierra Club's position more that the state should be investing in public transit, light rail, for example, for transportation between the cities, between the state's major cities, rather than cars?
Absolutely. Anybody who tries to travel on the I-4 corridor knows that it's a nightmare. And it's not because of the concentrated growth in places like Tampa and Orlando. It's because of the sprawl that has generated between the two and continues to build. And now you're going to increase that even further with these toll roads. What you need to do is follow the model of a city like St. Petersburg, which is building up. They are renovating that city, bringing more and more people into those cities and providing new services, new transportation, an ability for a renaissance to take place in each of our cities along Florida's coast. Secondly, we need to channel infrastructure funds to those rural communities that Senator Galvano has talked about. Let's bring them the sewage money. Let's bring them the money for Wi-Fi. Let's bring it to those small communities that dot U.S. 27 and U.S. 19, help them to improve their roads. Without building new toll roads miles to the west or east of the existing transportation corridors, that will turn those existing communities into ghost towns because development will shift to the intersections near eat the new toll roads. That will be the new place to be, and those existing communities are going to suffer as a result.
You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
What about the argument that we heard from the Senate president that there is congestion, that this is a response to the demands that the state's transportation grid is dealing with? And then also a related question for you, Frank. You're saying the Sierra Club and other environmental groups are going to declare total war on this. How do you plan to fight this, given that the governor has signed off on it and the plan, pending final approval, looks to be moving forward, construction slated to start at the end of the year 2022?
So to the first question, as you build new roads, you actually increase congestion and you increase driving times. So that in where Senator Galvano is in Bradenton, there's now a movement of development to the east. If you build the toll roads that go parallel to Bradenton, 70 miles out, then there's going to be infill. If that infill takes place all the way to Bradenton, then people are going to be traveling between those areas on all sorts of roads, between the toll roads and I-75, that will cause super congestion in that area. People are going to be commuting back and forth to work between various cities. And all of those roads, with the new people that are brought in, the new roads, the additional cars, are going to be congested. That is the history that we've seen in every urban metropolitan area that adds sprawl onto the existing urban city. So the second question is, how do we expect to conduct war? By war, we mean we're going to use all of our resources to fight this. We are going to go to court to fight these new roads and interchanges that are being built. We are going to hire organizers who will not only work with environmentalists, but people in the community who are opposed to these toll roads and who are going to be impacted by it. We are going to increase our lobbying efforts in the legislature to get them to repeal this bill and not to approve the funding necessary to build the roads. And finally, we're going to wage an election campaign so that people who continue to support these toll roads will be targeted for defeat in the next election.
Are these tactics that have worked in other states where the Sierra Club has tried to stop these types of toll road projects in other places around the country?
Yes. So I can recall a few years ago when we fought a major toll road near Salt Lake City in Utah, and we were able to stop it. Florida has had a history of building more and more roads, you know, and once you build the roads, the people come. We have 20 million people now. The people who want to build these toll roads and who are predicting, you know, hey, there's massive growth, you need to build the roads, you need economic development. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy that will lead to doubling Florida's population in 40 years. Can we survive?
And you think that's unsustainable? Is that
right?
It's
not sustainable. We do not have the water. We don't have the land resources. It's going to cause pollution. I mean, the pollution that we're having with red tide and harmful green algae, blue-green algae blooms right now, is partially caused by all of the people that we have brought in that are polluting our natural environment. If you double the population here, you're going to make that problem that much worse.
Florida's built on growth and development. Are you saying it quickly before we go to break? Are you saying it's time to change that economic model of the state?
We now, as people, probably have half the state of population under urban development. It's insane to think that we should be converting all of those ranches in the center of the state, all of that natural land in the Nature Coast portion of Florida north of Tampa, and then even building another corridor to Jacksonville, where you are, Melissa.
And Frank Jacalone, Florida chapter director of the Sierra Club, I want to thank you for being on the program today, along with Senate President Bill Galvano, who also appeared. Frank, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
Those were conversations on a program we first brought you in May.
Now, for drivers in Florida, this week also brought a new law affecting how you can use your cell phone behind the wheel. As of July 1st, it is now a primary offense to text while driving. That means you can be pulled over if a police officer sees you texting while you're in the driver's seat and when your car is moving. Fair warning to everyone out there. Debbie Wanenkoff from Key Biscayne has pushed lawmakers for 2 years now on a texting while driving bill.
Everyone I talk to says it's so dangerous to be in the car. You look in the car next to you when you're on I-95 and everybody's on their phone, or most people are on the phone.
Wanenkoff's son died while riding his bicycle in Oklahoma when he was hit by a driver on her phone. Now, Florida's new law is not an outright ban. It allows drivers to still text while stopped at a light or a stop sign. And it's still okay for drivers to check an address on their phone's map.
Still to come, meanwhile, voting security in Florida as the 2020 election nears. That's next. This is the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here from Florida Public Radio. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. And today is an encore program, so we won't be taking your calls or tweets, but we will be back live next week. When the Mueller report into Russian interference in the 2016 election was released back in March, well, investigators found that at least one Florida county had its voter database hacked. In May, after being given a secret briefing by the FBI, Governor Ron DeSantis said it was actually two counties that were hacked. Before that disclosure, we spoke with Ian Sancho. He is the former Leon County Supervisor of Elections. We started by asking about his reaction to the news that a Florida county election system had been compromised. Here's what he said.
I was not surprised, frankly. It's been clear to me that the election infrastructure, not only in Florida, but in the country, is not secure, has not been secure, and security was not a concern when the voting machine standards currently in place for all the 350,000 voting machines used in the United States were designed. Security was not an issue in the early 1980s. And most of the generation of voting equipment used in this country began in the 1980s, the development in the 1990s. It takes a while to get a new system up and running. But again, the systems themselves are not secure. and the
And when you say that, two vendors provide about 80% of U.S. election equipment, isn't that right? And
that
they have vulnerability. They have vulnerabilities. They could be targeted by someone on the inside, perhaps, who wanted to hack the vote, or an outside hacker, say Russian military intelligence. Can you explain those vulnerabilities for people?
Well, there are two types of vulnerabilities. The first type that people tend to think of is, are the voting machines themselves attackable? Can they be hacked? And that, fortunately, most of the voting equipment is not connected to the internet, nor should it ever be connected to the internet. But you connect it to modems, you connect it to disks, you can connect it to USBs. All of those are attack points to infiltrate systems and penetrate them. In terms of the state of Florida, we have paper ballots. We got paper ballots in 2007 when the touchscreen, known as DREs, direct recording electronic devices, in Sarasota County in 2006 lost 18,000 electronic votes. They disappeared. It could have been user error. It could have been voter error. We don't know, but this all goes back to 2000, when after that massive meltdown of poor technology and lack of well-trained election officials, this country decided to do something about it. But when they upgraded the technology, they did not upgrade the standards for security. Not at all. In fact, I went to Washington and spoke and testified before the House Administration Committee in support of Congressman Rush Holt's bill, by the way, who was a physicist in Congress, who demanded that our electronic voting machines have paper auditable trails. He failed in 2003. He failed in 2005. And that law has still not been passed. And if even if you have paper ballots such as Florida does use, we do not statistically audit those ballots to confirm that the numbers are correct. In fact, all we do is refeed them through the same machines, which, if they were compromised, would give us the same wrong number. Florida's audit system is among the worst in the country. And in fact, there was legislation in this legislative session in Florida that would have required that or allowed jurisdictions that had much more sophisticated audit equipment, equipment that could do a 100% recount of every vote independently cast from the voting system within 30 minutes. The Florida legislature refused to pass that legislation. So we have actually technology which could safeguard our paper ballots, which Florida law prevents election officials from using.
Let's go to Scott. He's an Interlochen. Hey, Scott, you're on the Florida Roundup. Go ahead.
Hey, the reason I'm calling is regards to the 2018 election, and it seemed like there was some malfeasance possibly going out in Broward County, and I'd like to see some kind of reform to where we have a supervisors of elections being appointed in instead of elected to make it easier for the state to intervene, because you know, law enforcement, independent supervisors should be able to come in and there was funny business going on down there, and we need some kind of regulation or new law passed, because it seemed like Rick Scott didn't want to jump in because Brenda Snipes was elected, and I mean, people weren't allowed in to watch them count votes. I saw the videos, and I'm concerned about that happening again as well.
All right, Scott, thanks for that. Let's talk about that and Ian Sancho, all of the issues around election security in Florida. Now, Scott was talking about the midterm elections and troubles with the vote in Broward County. Brenda Snipes, he referenced her, the former supervisor of elections in Broward. She came under heavy criticism. Some voters perceive malfeasance. Others said there was just incompetence going on there. But whether it comes to that or everything we're talking about vulnerabilities in our election systems, you know, attack points with USB or memory cards, cellular modems, that's another one where you can potentially hack a voting system in Florida. You know, all of this is serving to undermine voter confidence in elections, Ian, isn't it? People don't have confidence that their vote will be counted accurately.
Well, the danger is that if you speak the truth No one will act on it. And in fact, the individual who's speaking the truth then becomes the person that the government piles on. And I've had this myself. In 2006, we did something that was memorialized in a documentary called Hacking Democracy. We did a red team attack on the optical scan voting system that we used in Leon County, and we demonstrated that an individual could take over the memory card and, in fact, alter the outcome of the election, and the administrator who is running the election would not know about it.
You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
And in fact, that vulnerability was, once we exposed it, I was attacked by all three of the vendors that sold equipment here. They did not want that information out. The government, the governor and Secretary of State Glenda Hood began activities to try to remove me from office for exposing the truth. The issue is, if we want to bring credibility to the election system, we need to focus on the problems and the solutions, not attacking the individuals with who raised the questions that need to be raised. Our system is insecure. It could be made secure if we went to risk-limiting audits or machine audits that provided for the kind of re-examination independent of the voting software that counted it. The software is the problem. The software can be taken over. The software is buggy. The software has errors already built into it.
And isn't it possible to, and let me ask you this as a follow-up. Some cybersecurity experts have said hackers, Russian hackers or others, they could have planted malicious software that still hasn't even been detected. It can lie dormant and be activated at the appropriate time if you're trying to throw an election. Is that a valid concern?
Yes, it is, because the software can be written to erase itself after it has perpetrated its negative act. That is how dangerous the situation is. So, in fact, you must check the paper ballots. That's why Kirsten Nielsen, our former Homeland Security Director, testified in March before the Senate that if you are voting, you must be voting on a paper ballot. And if you're voting on a paper ballot and you're not doing an audit, you are a national security threat to the United States of America in 2019. And I see very few state legislators, state election directors, or even national figures acting with the kind of purpose to deal with that issue now. But let me tell you, we may never know who was hacked, because the FBI, because the FBI has a policy of not telling the truth relative to the disclosure of the methods and sources of how they find out information. Yeah. I was on the telephone call on September 30th, 2016, when the FBI had a confidential call with the supervisor of elections. And at that point, they told us that a malicious actor had attempted to penetrate a Florida vendor. That's all they would tell. We know now, based upon the reality winner information and the Mueller report, that the FBI actually lied to the 67 supervisor of elections and the Secretary of State staff that was on that call. The penetration had already taken place, but the FBI did not want to inform the Russians, and so they didn't inform us.
Here's a tweet from a listener. If it wasn't for a recount, we would have had the wrong agriculture commissioner. I believe the system is broken on the human level by crooked people.
I believe that without evidence showing that a valid audit has been accomplished, I don't think that we actually even know, for example, today, without even the Russian situation, what was the accurate vote in Hillsborough County? What was the accurate vote in Broward County? Both of those counties, after conducting their machine scan recounts and the 2018 election, ended up with vastly different totals at the end of the day. I know that in both jurisdictions, they took their total closest to the election. They did not use their retabulated totals that they generated from their precinct tabulators, because the numbers after they counted the votes then were so different from the election totals that they got right after the election, they didn't know which one is correct. And that goes to the flaw of, we do not do a reliable, scientifically valid recount to determine the accuracy of those votes on those pieces of papers that we call ballots.
Is it reasonable to expect an exact replica of count after count after count?
Yes. Yes. The idea, which kind of the myth that developed after the 2000 election, is you could never get an accurate count. That's hogwash. With optical scanned paper ballots, you can determine every vote marked on an optical scan paper ballot.
That was former Leon County Election Supervisor Ian Sancho speaking with us in May.
We'll be back next week with a live show. Meanwhile, thanks for listening to the Florida Roundup, produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Denise Royal are producers.
Our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Have a safe and happy 4th of July holiday weekend. We'll see you next week.